Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Compared to many states, New Hampshire has not suffered as severely from the pandemic this summer. But as fall approaches, there's lots of anxiety over how the coronavirus will evolve and how well the state will be able to keep track of the numbers and respond. Today in The Exchange, we're back with the state's top public health doctors to look ahead and answer your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state's epidemiologist, along with Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Well, welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming back once again. And Dr. Talbot, you first. For months, there's been talk about the possibility of a fall surge. Now fall's almost here. So Dr. Talbot, where do we stand at this moment?
We're all working hard at every level. So I know that people are being vigilant about social distancing and making masks just a part of their lives now. And we in public health are watching the emerging science and how we can continue to apply the tools we have and adapt to new tools that are coming for us. We're preparing for vaccine. We're receiving new approaches for diagnosis of this disease, and even getting some new treatments for those who do get disease. So again, it is a lot of work right now. There's ups and there's downs, but in general, I'm glad for an opportunity to share some of the good and hopeful news that's coming to us.
Will there be a fall surge, Dr. Talbot? Is that the fear, or do we know that there will be?
Oh, I think we don't know really anything with great certainty about this virus and the way it behaves. But the lessons we've learned from watching other countries, states, cities, is that this vaccine takes advantage of when people become lax in the non-pharmaceutical interventions like wearing a mask and social distancing and washing your hands, and also when people congregate together in the three C's, you know, in closed rooms, in close circumstances, and when there's anybody who's contagious. We have to keep vigilant, and again, as said, adapt to some new tools that are coming to us.
Dr. Chan, how would you answer that question? Where do we stand as we are almost ready to enter the fall, and for months people have told us there could likely be a fall surge?
Yeah, New Hampshire has done well, and New England as a whole has done well in terms of controlling the spread of this virus. But to be sure, the virus is still out there in our communities. It's still spreading, we believe, at low but persistent levels, and so the risk is still there. And not only in New Hampshire and New England, but the virus is present and circulating around the globe and in many other places within the United States. In fact, many states are seeing much higher incidence, much higher disease than New Hampshire. And so we remain at risk for another surge if people let their guards down. And guards down meaning people stop following the social distancing and cloth face mask recommendations. Now, we are not assured of having a surge in New Hampshire. We believe that at some point we very well may see an increase in the numbers. But the goal of the work that we're doing as a state and collectively, each and every one of us, is to prevent any increases or new introductions of the virus from turning into a surge. And I think we can be successful at that.
How can we be successful at that, Dr. Chan? And if I could fold into that question too, given that we also have regular flu season coming upon us, and we've got back to school, and we've already seen, you know, discussion about increased cases given that college kids are coming back on campus.
Yeah, and I think to my earlier comment, we should expect to see increases. And all of those situations will present their own new challenges, flu season. And it's not just flu season, it's circulation of other viruses as well, right? The CDC has predicted, increases in other types of viral infections and related complications around like enteroviruses and enterovirus season. So we are going to struggle with that this coming fall, trying to differentiate who has COVID and who has flu and who has another type of viral infection. And by the way, as a side note, that raises the importance of people getting the influenza vaccine this season. We don't yet have a COVID-19 vaccine, but there is an influenza vaccine that has been updated this year to be a better match for circulating strains of influenza. So to help us out, we are strongly recommending and encouraging people get the flu vaccine. But then, we're also facing challenges right now with preparing for school reopening. Colleges and universities are coming back. K-12 schools will be coming back. And we will continue to work with our partners around that to prevent early introduction of this virus into those communities and to detect and respond to signs of early spread of COVID-19 in those communities. So part of that is going to include more testing. So people can expect more cases, I think, going into the fall months, especially as schools reopen. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that's our tools and strategies working to detect people with COVID-19 and prevent it from spreading.
Well, and I've got some questions for you a little bit later about testing and some of the shifts that we've seen in the testing regime here in the state. But Dr. Talbot, to you first, you piqued my interest. You mentioned hopeful news in terms of a vaccine and in terms of treatments. So give us a little more there, please.
We've learned a lot about taking care of patients with this disease. Moving in from the prevention to treatment of those with disease, we have been rock steady in New Hampshire with approximately 10% of those who are confirmed with disease requiring hospitalization. But once they arrive to hospitalization, I think we're better at taking care, right? So we now have remdesivir as a treatment that's been shown to be helpful with regards to duration of hospitalization, reflective of severity, and also even a hint at decreasing mortality from this disease. We also know how to ventilate people better if they require that. So there's a lot of strategies for the doctors, even beyond specific medications. And just last week, we learned that the FDA reviewed data that they thought was favorable enough regarding convalescent plasma that we can use that now routinely. So that's another tool we have. We know that steroids in the form of dexamethasone can help people who are in that late inflammatory stage from this virus. So I'm very hopeful that clinicians now have something in their armamentarium that's going to be helpful to keep people out of the hospital maybe or in for a shorter duration and certainly to survive that hospitalization. So there's a lot of news on that front.
That's good news. So if the worst happens and someone gets it and they are hospitalized, the treatments are better. Very briefly, Dr. Talbot, what about a vaccine? We did a show a couple weeks ago on this, and it looked like the herd immunity that we'd all hope a vaccine would give us is a long, long way away. What can you tell us about this?
In public health, we have been for, I would say, decades. Working on plans that make sense in our jurisdiction on how to distribute a limited resource. In those plans that have been set out already, the focus was pandemic influenza. So these are being adapted now quite actively for the eventuality of the COVID-19 vaccine. As I'm sure you discussed on the show, but to remind that there are parallel strategies for targeting a vaccine right now. And there's enough optimism around some of these strategies that they're going into production even, so that when the evidence is there that this is safe and effective, we'll be ready to start distributing first to those who are at highest need, those who are on our front lines like healthcare workers, and those who suffer most with this disease, like elderly or those with other illnesses that make them vulnerable to the worst outcomes.
Wow. Dr. Chan, I got to ask you about vaccines as well. This is so important.
So, one of the reasons we may see a vaccine sooner than we normally would is because at the federal level, they have diverted funds to not only study the vaccine, but also to ramp up production in the event that a safe and effective vaccine can be found. So when exactly we're going to see a vaccine, I think is still a little bit up in the air, but there are multiple candidate vaccines that are currently being studied, including at least a couple in what we call phase three trials, where they're enrolling, tens of thousands of people to further study not only the safety of the vaccine, but also the efficacy, so that if and when a safe and effective vaccine can be found, that vaccine is already being produced. And so there's federal funds being diverted into those efforts so that we could potentially have a preliminary, result and a preliminary amount of a small amount of vaccine potentially by the end of this year, which is what we're hearing from the federal government. But, it's true what Dr. Talbot said is that, this vaccine will not be, if a safe, effective vaccine can be found, will not be in great supply in the beginning. And there will have to be a ramp-up phase to get moving any vaccine out into the broader public setting.
I want to remind our listeners that today on The Exchange, we are talking with the state's two top public health doctors. We are looking at how the coronavirus pandemic evolved in New Hampshire this summer and some of the anxiety around the pandemic as fall approaches. We welcome your questions and comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dr. Chan, again, reflecting back on the summer, looking ahead to the fall, a few months ago, Dr. Chan, where did you hope we would be at this point in terms of testing, in terms of treatment, and our overall containment of this virus?
Yeah, so given what was happening at a national level a couple of months ago, right, the many other states, most other states, in fact, outside of New England, were seeing new surges, accelerations in their outbreaks. And as a nation, largely those outbreaks are we're flattening the curve, so to speak, as a country. And I think there was broad concern that by this time, we would have seen or started to see increases in New Hampshire because of what was happening in the rest of the country. And so we haven't seen that, which is good news. And I think that that speaks to the strategies that we've implemented at a community level that people have taken on individually. Those community mitigation measures have been working and continue to work because we have not seen an increase like we were fearful of. If anything, the numbers have continued to improve in New Hampshire very, very slowly. So, I think in regards to the pandemic, we're in a better spot today than we were 2 months ago. We haven't seen a new surge. We've managed to be able to control and prevent, further spread within our communities. But as we enter the fall season, that risk is still there and is potentially even increased. And so we still need people to heed the public health recommendations around social distancing, cloth face mask use, hand hygiene, avoiding crowded locations whenever possible, staying home when people are feeling ill or having symptoms of COVID-19, and in fact, not just staying home, but going to get tested. Those continue to be the primary mitigation measures, community mitigation measures. Remember, the package layers of interventions to prevent this virus from spreading and spreading rapidly within our communities.
Dr. Talbot, what about a sense of complacency as these concerns about fall approach? And both of you have said, as more people go back to school, as people move indoors, there is a concern that cases could rise. On the other hand, as Dr. Chan says, New Hampshire has done pretty well. Does that breed a sense of, well, it's okay. We can go ahead and have that party, Dr. Talbot.
Thanks for that difficult question. We are, every one of us, experiencing battle fatigue. I think none of us expected to or wanted to be here where we have to wear masks and we have to forego typical human social interaction. No doubt, this is a terrible time for us, and none more so than for our elderly, particularly in congregate settings. You know, we want life to go back to normal, and we just can't. We are learning how to dance with this virus. You know, when is it right to keep shut down? When can we open up a bit more? We have to damp it down again. We have to try some new strategies. So this is going to go on, and we need to stay strong. So I want to encourage everyone to think of it as a marathon and not a sprint. Clearly, it's not a sprint. We're in this, as I said, way longer than we hoped for. That we, you know, we're just here. This is a long-term event. It may shape our culture in ways we can't even imagine right now. But we have to stay strong now if we want to continue to enjoy the degree that we're opened, and stay here to avoid some of that morbidity and mortality that will surely reemerge if we loosen our guidance around masks and social distance.
Let's go back to our listeners, both of you. And Jane is calling from Epping. Welcome, Jane. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
I guess my question and concern is, how are we going to keep up this fall and winter with testing? We've been lucky in New Hampshire, thankfully, but like my sons are in daycare and one of them just had the tiniest runny nose. And so, of course, the protocols, he should stay home. And I completely 100% understand that. We got a COVID test. It was negative. And then he was able to go back when his symptoms were clear, which only took a day. But my question is, you know, during the school year and daycare, kids' nose is always runny. And how are we going to keep up with that testing if every time a parent or child gets a runny nose or has a sore throat, they have to get a COVID test? And for instance, if my son had that little cold, he was negative. And then what if the next day my other son feels that symptom, or my husband and I do? Do we need to then go get a test, or do we assume that we caught his cold and we would be negative too? Or do we need to socially isolate? It's confusing as the winter comes on what to do and the protocols.
Absolutely. Jane, if I could ask you, so how long did it take you to get your testing results, and where did you go for that test?
Yeah, we were really lucky. We got our results back under 48 hours, probably like 1.5 days. And we did a drive-through near Exeter Hospital, a drive-up COVID test. It was very easy, which was great. I had a friend that lives in Montana, and she says their testing is like 2 weeks out, which is obviously inefficient.
Right. Thank you so much for calling, Jane, because Dr. Chan, Dr. Talbot, we always get lots of questions from listeners about testing. And I want to start big, but then get into some detail. So Dr. Chan, you first. New Hampshire's testing capacity, if you had to grade it overall, what would that grade be? You know, A+, C-?
Boy, I haven't thought about a grade here, but I will say that I think New Hampshire has done very well in the testing arena. You know, in the B+ to A+ range. And I appreciate Jane's questions and comments here, because I think she's absolutely right that what she expressed, it is the position that and the recommendations that we have taken around people with even mild symptoms of COVID-19 should get tested, because we just don't know. Or somebody just can't know if they have COVID-19 without testing, because the symptoms of COVID-19 are so broad. And so to be protective of our schools, our childcare, our businesses, our communities, we have taken a strict stance on this in terms of recommending that people with any even mild symptoms of COVID-19 should not be allowed into school, into businesses, and go get testing. But Jane is absolutely right that then this, and you're absolutely right, and your listeners are absolutely right, that then this raises problems and potential issues around, well, do we have the testing capacity? And I would say that right now, yes, we have the testing capacity. In fact, the turnaround time, the average turnaround time in our state for various labs is on the order of 2, maybe 3 days, which is a lot better from where we were even, you know, a few weeks ago, where other states are, as you have heard. You know, we have made efforts to not only procure the necessary supplies to do testing, but to make testing widely available within communities. And anybody in our state, whether they're having symptoms or no symptoms, can seek out testing in their communities And we maintain an active current list of testing locations around our state where people can go. If, for whatever reason, a primary care provider doesn't offer it, they can go online to nh.gov/COVID-19. And there's a drop-down menu under resources tab on that page, the resources and guidance tab, for that lists out a map and a list of all the available testing resources in the state. So I think, you know, New Hampshire has done a very good job in this regard. I would actually probably give us an A in this arena, because we have early on and continue to make testing readily available that people can take advantage of.
Well, a couple points from here. And first of all, Dr. Chan, to Jane's, I'm putting myself in her shoes. So her child has the sniffles, that's 48 hours. Then the other child gets the sniffles, that's another 48 hours. Then maybe should she and her husband get tested? If they get the sniffles, that's another 48 hours. So I just wonder, Dr. Chan, I have heard of a few places that have a 45-minute turnaround. And I can't help but think, that would be a game changer for families like Jane's and for everybody, really. Is that even a remote possibility, a quick turnaround like that?
Yes. And so I appreciate you asking that question, because we are there are different testing technologies that are out there. And we believe that the most reliable, most accurate tests are those that do the back of the nose swabs that then get sent to a lab for the PCR-based test. Those PCR-based tests are what we use to diagnose active infection. The downside of those tests, even though they're the most accurate, is that it can take, you know, 2-3 days to get the result back. There are other testing technologies, what we call point of care or more rapid tests, that can be done in a matter of, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes. And so some of those tests have already made it out into the communities, usually at hospital locations. But there are other tests, antigen-based tests, that detect particles of the virus that we are looking to try and looking at their availability and whether, you know, these are tests we can roll out in our communities that have a turnaround time of, you know, 20, 30 minutes. The issue around some of these tests is that they're a little bit less accurate, we believe, than the PCR-based tests. But also there's some issues around availability. The federal government has actually been buying up a lot of these tests because they've been rolling them out to nursing homes. But we are looking into our state's ability to try and, you know, get some of these tests for our communities around the state, because that would be a solution to the problem that you and Jane have highlighted here around requiring many people to get tested and needing to stay out while those test results are pending.
The state is in the process of shutting down its own testing sites, you know, run by the National Guard, for example. I went to the one here in Concord several times, and instead having hospitals and urgent care clinics become the primary testing locations. Is this, Dr. Chan, going to increase testing capacity? Because it did seem like the state testing sites and were, you know, they took everybody, you didn't even need an appointment, it was better if you had one, they didn't ask any questions, they didn't ask for insurance. The community-based settings seem to be more fussy. You know, you got to fill out a form. Sometimes they won't take you if you don't have symptoms, or they don't consider you high risk. So I wonder, are we going to see more sites offering testing, but that testing, Dr. Chan, will be more limited by the restrictions that some of these private providers are putting on testing?
Yeah, so the transfer, you're absolutely right that some of what the state has been conducting in terms of the sites staffed by National Guard that have been doing the specimen collection, those responsibilities are being transferred to the healthcare system in many communities. That should not decrease the ability or capacity of people to get tested. Instead of the state running specimen collection sites ourselves, we have worked with health systems and hospitals around the state to transfer that same access to the local healthcare system, which, you know, in the ideal world is where it should reside, I think, right? They're the ones with the medical experts and the resources, the training even. And so the state has developed contracts with these healthcare systems listed on our website for maintaining the same services and the same capacity that was offered through the state-run testing sites. And by the way, the Concord site is still up and running. It's still being staffed and run by the state and the National Guard. And so there are state-run facilities that are still in operation around the state. But we encourage people to go online, nh.gov/COVID-19, and look at our testing resources. There's a quite a large list of sites that offer testing to people, including people without insurance, people that might not have primary care providers. Those options are available to anybody for testing.
So I'm wondering about that, Dr. Chan, because the access doesn't feel the same. I went on a bunch of these websites myself yesterday. One of them said, you can't get tested. You're not high risk enough. Another one said I had to be, quote unquote, evaluated by a doctor before they'd give a test. And it seemed like a pretty detailed process of evaluation. A couple others had, you know, a bunch of questions they asked. It did feel to me, and I did go to, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 different community locations just to sort of play with it and see what it was like. And it didn't feel as easy as that sort of one-stop shopping state site. It felt like the private providers weren't as open in terms of their access.
Well, that's interesting to hear, and I appreciate that feedback. That's something we will certainly feedback to our partners, our testing team here. But the intention is to keep the access the same. Now, when you go through a healthcare system, usually there is a requirement for there to be some type of evaluation in order to conduct the testing. And so there may be some differences in the process, but the access should be comparable between different sites.
Will this lead to the continuation, Dr. Chan, of the centralized reporting of results, given now that there are so many entities involved in testing? Will we still have even though we don't have one-stop shopping anymore for registering for testing, will we still have one-stop shopping in terms of getting the data?
Yes, hopefully, right? I mean, this is always a moving target. COVID-19 is a reportable disease, so we ask labs and providers to report anybody with positive test results to New Hampshire Public Health. We also are asking the laboratories that do the testing to report negative results as well, so that we have broader sense of the amount of testing and the test positivity. And we have mechanisms established with the hospitals and with the major national reference laboratories to have this reporting conducted in near real time, what we call electronic laboratory reporting. And so much of the testing that is being done is being done at laboratories through whom we have this ongoing relationship and mechanism established for automated reporting. Now, there's a lot of, new labs coming on that are doing testing. There are these point of care, practice-based tests, where there might not be an already established automated electronic, reporting feed set up. And so we are continuing to work with new labs, new testing partners to make sure that the reporting is done on both positive and negative results.
All right. We're going to take a very quick break. But when we come back, we will go to our listeners, some emails coming in. You can send in your questions at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll also reflect back on the summer tourism season, what we learned there, especially with Labor Day approaching. And again, we'll take more of your questions. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, the state's top public health doctors on how the coronavirus affected New Hampshire this summer and what they're concerned about for the fall. Let's hear from you, listeners. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. And Dr. Chan, Dr. Talbot, to you first, as a doctor, as an infectious disease specialist, as you watch this return to school, K through 12, return to college, what are you thinking about, Dr. Talbot? What's coming up for you?
That we need to continue to embrace our strategy, right? There's been so much talk about, especially at the college and university level, that that it might be difficult for those who are in the college age to adhere to that. So we need to enable it. We need to normalize it, right? We expect that we will see cases at colleges, universities, K to 12, and we have to hone our ability to respond to that in a compassionate and resilient way as these new tools like the diagnostic testing we've been talking about come to us. I'm particularly excited to talk about the antigen test because it does meet that need that we have to have a quick answer. And I thought I would give the analogy that a lot of people are familiar with for these tests as like the rapid flu test or the strep test that they can get in their doc's offices. So the model is that a positive test result can help us to move quicker on some of these clusters in universities and schools, whereas a negative test might need further validation. But a positive test can really be trusted. And that's what we need. We need to be able to trust the results we get and act on them fast. So that's very much on my mind. And working with public health now, of course, that's so much of what we do during a day is respond to these positives that might reflect an opportunity for there to be a more widespread outbreak. So just to reassure you again that we're applying the new tools and we're working very hard to strike fast when we hear of any of these cases in the school setting.
Sure. And NHPR's Daniela Ali has a comprehensive story on how state universities are addressing back to school, back to campus. And I really encourage listeners to check it out at nhpr.org. And Dr. Talbot, Daniela has reported on just how extensively colleges are doing this. Dartmouth College sending saliva-based tests to undergraduates prior to arrival. University System of New Hampshire requiring students to have a negative COVID-19 test before arrival. I wonder, Dr. Talbot, given the struggles that we've seen in local school districts over whether to reopen or not, and this has been very acrimonious and difficult, is this level of testing even possible at the K through 12 level? Because it seems to me that would be really helpful for those districts to have.
It may be different because the colleges and universities are residential, such as that. So it can create a bubble of low-level virus or absent virus if they test out anybody with contagious disease. You can imagine the strategies to control at K to 12 are different because people are not in their own student bubble, but they have interactions with family, some of whom have traveled, et cetera. So we're dancing with the right strategies of how do you allow children to develop normally, to learn, to be educated, to socialize, and yet avoid their role in propagating disease to their more vulnerable family members or teachers or staff, et cetera. So I see some distinct differences in those environments, but you're right that the new normal for testing in K to 12 will be a very low threshold. And I wanted to take it the next step, not only the new or unexplained or mild illness that might be COVID-19, but even asymptomatic persons who are known to be in contact with somebody with confirmed disease. So I just want to say again that in New Hampshire, we continue to be dedicated to facilitating persons who are at risk for disease to get testing, even if they have no symptoms. So that's an important.
Well, that's so important, yeah, because as you have told me many times, 40% of people with COVID-19 are either asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic. So hopefully the new testing sites are getting up and running will not require symptoms, right, Dr. Talbot? Because so many people don't have any symptoms at all.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah, that even if you're asymptomatic, you're capable of transmitting disease. So this is a science unto itself as to when to strategize testing in an asymptomatic person who's been exposed and what that means if it's negative, what that means if it's positive. But for us in New Hampshire, I think part of our success has been being very strategic and testing asymptomatic persons just as soon as we know they might be at risk of shedding this virus.
Well, one more question about back to school and testing. And Dr. Chan, this is for you. You know, as the guy who kind of tracks New Hampshire's numbers and reports on them, how are college student test results being folded into our current state numbers? Are students who are getting tested and then coming to New Hampshire being reported in our daily numbers? How is that going to work, keeping track of college students and our overall state numbers?
That's a great question. And people that get tested in other states, those results do not come to us, right? At the time of testing, they're a resident, they're in another state. That result gets reported to the state public health jurisdiction, which the person is a resident of. We want people, when they come to New Hampshire, like a college student, if they're getting tested at the campus, the college campus, university campus, they should have their university college address listed as their location so that the test result will come to us. You know, sometimes if somebody puts the wrong address down or they're putting an out-of-state address down, that result will initially go to the state in which they list their permanent address as, and it should eventually make it to us if that person is positive. But there can be a delay. And so we need people when they get tested, college students, people coming in from other states, if they're getting tested in New Hampshire, to list their residence in New Hampshire as their residential address. And that way we can be reassured that the test result will come to us.
Let's go back to the phones. And Gary is calling in from Randolph. Hi, Gary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura. My concern is oversight of the testing. I have heard from reliable sources that Littleton Hospital is actually having people get out of the vehicles to be tested, and they're actually drawing blood and doing other add-ons. So is there a state oversight of the testing sites to make sure that it's being done correctly, number one? And number two, when you start to privatize this rather than have the state do it, there's an opportunity for private entities to do add-ons and add cost to something that should just be a simple test for COVID.
You know, I really appreciate this call, Gary. And Dr. Chan, what kind of state oversight will there be over these private entities to make sure they do it right, as Gary says, and to make sure that they make it relatively easy? As I suggested earlier, it didn't seem that easy when I was on some of these private sites yesterday.
So we have a team that is working with our partners around the state to ensure that they are offering consistent testing services. I think it is important to mention that there are different types of tests that are out there, and our healthcare providers are experts in how to collect clinical specimens. This is what they do on a daily basis. I think Gary's point, you know, there are different ways of collecting specimens and different processes depending upon the local setup and local facilities. So not all sites may have, for example, drive-up testing where they collect the specimen in the car. There may be sites that require someone to get out of the car, for example. There's not necessarily a problem with that as long as it's done safely. But our healthcare partners are experts in collecting these types of specimens. Regarding the mention of a blood draw, right, there are antibody-based tests which require a blood draw, and we don't recommend an antibody-based test to test for active infection. That's not the right test. But healthcare providers can and will make individual decisions based on sort of a case-by-case basis whether they need to assess for past infection with COVID-19, which could include a blood draw. That is part of the service that we have made available and when we'll continue to make available to people. And that's part of the reason for there needing to be potentially a preliminary or minimal clinical assessment before someone gets tested. What is the appropriate test for someone to have? Are they having current active symptoms of COVID-19, in which case they should be getting some type of nasal swab, for example, or PCR-based test? Or is there a concern for past infection and someone wants to know whether they've been exposed in the past, in which case it might involve a blood draw and an antibody test. But certainly the right test for someone who is symptomatic and is being evaluated for active infection that can be spread to others is the nose swabs, the nasal swabs, to conduct a PCR-based test. But I think each site is going to be a little bit different, but these are our experts, and they know how to collect the appropriate specimens and how to correctly assess people.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned antibody testing, Dr. Chan. And Dr. Talbot, just remind us what antibody testing is and what we know about it now, because there's been some murkiness around how useful having antibody testing is.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about antibody testing because there's a lot going on in that arena. I'd love for folks to know. So antibodies are what a person's body produces against any kind of pathogen, especially in this case, we're talking about the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So this is your body's, attack on the virus. And it's a measure of the memory of that battle. It doesn't reflect an active battle in most cases. So I'd like to say and follow to Dr. Chan's that getting an antibody test because you're curious about what happened back in March or so is really not a good use of resources. And I wanted to share with you that antibodies, first of all, come in different flavors, if you will. There are all different kinds of antibodies. And the ones we really want to learn more about are those that are called neutralizing antibodies. So you can hear in that name that this is an antibody that neutralizes the virus, that kills the virus, that destroys the virus. And our hope is that when you've had infection once, those neutralizing antibodies are present to attack it if you see it again. This past week, we've had some pretty sobering news that it turns out a person who has had infection can get infection again. It might be that those neutralizing antibodies wane. They just go away over time, and it looks like that magic number is beyond 3 months. So I tell you that not to create despair and depression, which was my first reaction to that news, but rather to say that if you know that you've had disease, it's still relevant to protect yourself. And it's still relevant to protect those around you, that if you have symptoms, you should be retested beyond 3 months of your first encounter. So there's a lot going on in the antibody arena. This is a blood test, and it's not right now appropriate for people who are just curious, so to speak, especially now that we have the news that one can become reinfected.
So what is it useful for if it isn't useful for the individual who wants to know? And if we now know that, sadly, you could possibly get reinfected, what is the point of antibody testing?
It tells us so much about how this virus moves in our society. So it is the only test really that's given us the answer about how much asymptomatic disease there's been, for example. Right. So if only symptomatic people get tested using that PCR test looking for the genetic material or the antigen test looking for bits and pieces of the virus, then we're only going to know the active snapshot of infection. But the antibody test as an epidemiologic, as a public health tool, lets us know how many people have been affected by this. And those are a significant proportion completely asymptomatic. So this has told us about how this virus moves in our population.
So who should get tested for antibodies, Dr. Talbot, and who shouldn't to fulfill those functions that you just mentioned?
Organized surveillance programs where a public health jurisdiction wants to answer that question. I think that those do happen where antibody testing is part of an organized program to sample our population. You've probably heard some of that that's happened internationally, but also in our own United States, like New York City has done a very careful, thorough surveillance use testing of antibody. And that's shown us that a very significant proportion of that population had been affected during their surge and their peak of epidemic, but it's nowhere near what people refer to as herd immunity. It is not high enough to prevent transmission from person to person. So that's just an incredibly important bit of information for us as we strategize going forward.
Wow. Okay. Well, coming up, more of your questions, phone calls, emails. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, the state's top public health doctors on how the coronavirus has affected New Hampshire this summer and what they're concerned about for the fall. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot, we have received so many comments from listeners over the summer about tourism, and now Labor Day is approaching, so I want to ask you about it again. We've had lots of large events in New Hampshire. I shouldn't say lots, but several. NASCAR, Bike Week. We've got the Trump rally happening in Manchester this Friday. And Dr. Chan, how well do we understand the health impact of the out-of-state travel, especially with these large events?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk, at least the last several days, around whether people who are traveling need to quarantine, right? And so we use the term quarantine to indicate people staying home and out of public places when there may be a risk factor for exposure, either exposure to someone with confirmed COVID-19 or someone who has traveled. And so the last several days, the CDC apparently has stopped instructing people coming into the United States from international travel. Has stopped instructing them on a need to quarantine. And so there's been a lot of questions around travelers, especially coming into New Hampshire. And I just want to be clear that our recommendations remain the same. People coming into New Hampshire or who have gone from New Hampshire and traveled outside of New England, if they're coming into New Hampshire from outside of New England, they need to quarantine for 14 days. That continues to be the stance that we have taken and many other states have taken in our area. That anybody with travel outside of the six New England states, so Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, anybody who has traveled outside of that area and is coming into New Hampshire needs to quarantine for 14 days from the last day of their travel, essentially meaning that they need to stay home, out of public places, distance themselves from other people for 14 days. Because we know that that is the time period in which someone who has been exposed to COVID-19 can potentially come down with symptoms and show symptoms of COVID-19.
So I'm looking at the state's website, and it says the two-week quarantine has been lifted just for those New England states, as you said, Dr. Chan. But then it says those traveling to New Hampshire from non-New England states for an extended period of time are still asked to self-quarantine for a two-week period. So what does that mean, Dr. Chan? Traveling to New Hampshire from non-New England states for an extended period of time, does that mean if someone's coming up from New York for the weekend, they don't need to quarantine? I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the baseline message there is that if you're staying in New Hampshire and have traveled outside of New England, you should be staying put in your place of residence where you're staying. You know, I think there's exceptions made if someone's, you know, traveling up for a hike, for example, they're going to be outside, or, you know, quarantine implies a longer duration of stay. But I would say even if someone is coming up, coming from out of New England and staying for the weekend, the requirement is still for them to stay put in their place of residence and out of public places. That doesn't mean they have to stay locked up in their room the whole time. You know, we encourage people to get outdoors and stay active. But they should be out of public places, staying put as much as possible, avoiding crowds, avoiding close contact with other people.
I see. And it says those traveling to New Hampshire from non-New England states are still, I'm quoting here, are still asked to self-quarantine for a two-week period. Is asked enough, Dr. Chan? In Europe and Canada, they don't ask, they tell you. And they'll fine you if they catch you. I mean, is asking really enough?
Yeah, so we have public health authority to require and mandate that people quarantine for whatever reason, whatever disease we're talking about. We use that public health authority in only very select circumstances. And there's a whole process for, you know, that for requiring somebody to quarantine, which involves serving a quarantine order. That person has then has recourse to go to, you know, the court to contest the quarantine order, right? So there's a whole legal process by which we can require people to quarantine. And in limited circumstances, we do that. For example, if there's a very high-risk exposure, someone's an identified, you know, close contact, household contact, but is refusing to stay home, we can, and in some circumstances, have issued quarantine orders, but that is the minority of situations. Most of the time, where there is not an identified high-risk exposure to COVID-19, and most of the travel-related risk factors would fall into that, we simply ask people to self-quarantine and do not require or enforce that through a public health order.
Here's an email that came in from Anne, who says, why does New Hampshire have almost 80% more COVID cases than Maine? These are Anne's numbers, not mine. She says 7,159 versus 4,389, and more than three times the deaths. And then Anne says 430 in New Hampshire versus 132 in Maine. Anne says Maine and New Hampshire have almost the exact same population and the same demographics. Maine has a mandatory mask mandate, but Governor Sununu still refuses to issue one. This must account for many of the cases in New Hampshire. Anne, thank you for writing. And Dr. Talbot, we talk about this a lot. How much would a mask mandate help New Hampshire get better control of this thing?
Clearly, masks help prevent transmission from the person wearing the mask. So this is the source control that we speak about passionately. And I don't know the incremental improvement that would come from having there be a statute for such. I do know that a lot of folks were pleased that there is now a mask requirement for the grouping of people where we know that there can be some super spreader events, if you will. So you mentioned earlier NASCAR and Bike Week and political rallies and protests and such. So we are looking to at least make sure that in those kinds of settings, the organizers are enabling and facilitating mask use, because that's where we're really going to affect our epidemiology. That's where we are right now. I don't make policy, but I hope everybody understands that there's no question that the science suggests that this mask use is going to help us stay as open and as healthy as we are right now.
You know, one last question for both of you, and then we'll have to wrap it up. As we said earlier, we're almost 6 months into this virus. Dr. Chan, I think you alluded to this. You know, mental health experts are concerned about the emotional strain on people being separated. Elders want to be with their loved ones. Kids want to have sleepovers with their friends. Dr. Chan, what's your message to listeners as they try to make these decisions with, you know, this virus is still here. It's not going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think the message is what we have said in the past, which is we need to, and we are finding a pathway to live with this virus, right? We are not going to eradicate the virus. It's still circulating. There's new evidence of the potential for reinfection. This virus is not going away anytime soon. And one of the things that has been so difficult really is balancing the different priorities, balancing the priority to control the pandemic, balancing people's emotional mental health, their financial well-being, you know, preventative health. There's a very difficult balance act going on now, and we need to find a way to live with this virus because it is not going away likely anytime soon. And Dr. Talbot used the term dance, right? This is really what we're doing. We're dancing with this virus, and it's a bad dance partner, right? It's throwing in moves that are unexpected. It's, you know, not following our lead. It's stepping on our feet. But we are out there, and we're trying to give frame and control to this virus so that it prevents harm, minimizes impact on our communities. And we need everybody, businesses, individuals, communities, families, to engage with us in this effort to continue to prevent it from spreading. And we can do that. We have been successful at doing that. But it's still present. It's still circulating in low but persistent levels in our communities. And so we need people to continue to work with us to implement the social distancing, the cloth face masks, the hand hygiene, you know, staying home when you're sick and getting tested, avoiding large crowds. Those are still the primary ways that we have to dance with this virus and control it until we get a safe, effective vaccine.
Dr. Taub, I'd love your thoughts, too, just briefly. The message to families as they approach the fall and the possibility of increased virus spread.
That we're a resilient animal, humans. You know, as Dr. Tan said, we are developing ways to live with this. And we need to continue to be brave and strong and think of creative ways to capture what's most important in our lives in spite of this virus. So learning to live with it as opposed to hoping it's just going away, I think is the parting blow here, that we need to create resilient, sustainable, creative approaches to this. And we are watching the emerging science and trying to apply it in those ways. So that's right. It's not time for the sleepovers to start happening again or the large groups without the masks. We're just not there, and we will not get there soon.
Well, both of you, thank you. I hate to cut you off there. You've both been very generous with your time for the past 6 months since this whole thing started. So we really appreciate you being with us. Thank you. And this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.